Welcome to Wilderness Podcast, a passion project about wilderness and wild places with your host, Adam Bronstein. Hello, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Wilderness Podcast. If you're listening via web browser, I encourage you to X out of that and to pick up your phone. And whether it's an Android or an iPhone, doesn't matter, head over to your podcasting app, search on Wilderness Podcast, and you'll find the green logo with the bear. From there, you can subscribe. Subscriptions are free, and you'll be notified of new releases. You can also scroll back and listen to previous episodes, and you can pick up where you left off on this one. We're also available on Stitcher and Spotify and a few other third-party apps. Just a reminder for all my listeners out there that all views expressed on this program by me are mine and mine alone. That goes for past episodes and also my social media accounts as well. The views expressed here do not necessarily reflect those of any organizations that I am affiliated with. In this episode, I speak with John Marvel, founder of Western Watersheds Project and their first executive director. We talk about his background, his first experiences on public lands in Idaho, what public lands means to him, looking at ecosystems with fresh eyes, the vast destruction from intensive livestock grazing on public lands, a vision for public lands without the cows, multiple use mandates, the Bundy clan, the contentious founding of Idaho Watersheds Project, which is the precursor to Western Watersheds Project, buying grazing leases for conservation purposes, why some conservation groups don't address the issue of public lands grazing, reflecting back on his time with Western Watersheds Project, legislative buyout programs, grazing is the most ubiquitous use of public lands, and the reasons why grazing destroys ecosystems. For full disclosure, I just wanted to make mention that I am the new Idaho director with Western Watersheds Project. And yeah, I had a great chat with John, so I really hope you enjoy this episode and learn something new. Thanks for tuning in. John Marvel, thanks for joining me on the podcast. I really appreciate your time. We're here in beautiful Idaho. The landscape is stunning as always, and it's just a beautiful place, and I'm very grateful to be sitting here with you today. I'd like for my audience to learn about you and your past and what brought you to the work that you did throughout your life. So maybe you could just tell us about yourself, where you grew up, and let's start there.
Well, I'm glad to have you here, Adam. Thanks for coming. I actually grew up in Delaware, one of the least varied states in the country, being so small, where the highest point above sea level, I think, is about 400 feet.
Did you grow up near Wilmington?
I did.
Newark, that area?
No, I grew up in a suburb of Wilmington called Greenville, and in fact, where I grew up was on a 40-acre kind of a quasi-farm where our place is where Joe Biden lives right now.
On the property you grew up?
Yes.
No kidding.
That's right.
How about that?
So anyway, I went to school there, and I went away to boarding school, and then I went to the University of Chicago. And I have a degree in American history from the University of Chicago. And then, because I had worked in Idaho in summers as a teenager, because my older sister was living here, I had liked it so much here that we moved here in 1969 and have been here ever since. In the interim, I did go back to graduate school at the University of Oregon in Eugene, where I received a master's degree in architecture. And I am a licensed architect and have been for 40 years and have designed a lot of buildings in the Wood River Valley, central Idaho, and parts of Washington State. But I became disillusioned with public lands management by living next to the National Forest here in central Idaho and coming into contact firsthand with public lands ranching and all the negative aspects of it, which I had not understood before. And that galvanized me in several different ways to become an activist, which I did.
So what really drew you to Idaho and the West when you first visited? What do you remember being most striking about your experience here?
Well, I think the critical thing was the presence of public lands as compared to where I grew up. Where I grew up, if you stepped off a public road, generally you would be trespassing. Whereas in this particular county in Idaho, Custer County, it's 97% public land, and it includes some fantastic, as you know, mountain ranges, rivers, and what I consider to be earthly benefits. And once I discovered that, I started doing a lot of hiking in the mountains and mountaineering, and then river trips, and all of that made clear to me that it was so important to be next to places where you could go and you might not see people for a week or 10 days. And there's extraordinary value in that experience.
What do public lands mean to you?
Well, public lands are a kind of freedom to experience the natural world at whatever level of understanding you have. Any person doing that is going to have a learning experience and have their lives expanded dramatically from whatever it was before. And public lands provide that in spades. And yet, I think many of our fellow Americans don't really understand the huge value that's waiting for them.
What do you say to people who are living in cities that, you know, they've heard of maybe Yellowstone or Yosemite, you know, they're thinking about the West. Like, what is out here? Like, what do they own? What is in the public trust that belongs to every American in this country?
Well, it's an extraordinary litany of values that can't really be described in short form because there are so many positive attributes. Everything from wildlife to water, flowing water, still water, mountains, meadows. It's just the intensity of the ecosystem around us is present, often with a lesser degree of human manipulation than we're accustomed to in other places. People may think of a farm field as nature, but really, it's an altered environment that has lost a great deal in the process. And so public lands enable us to re-experience who we are.
So as we think about all of these wide open spaces, and a lot of it is still wild, but outside of the built environment, of course, of our cities, and like you were mentioning, our pastures of our East Coast areas and farmlands, there still is a lot of manipulation that has happened out here, and that's what you've observed by living in Idaho. What did you begin to realize was happening here when you started exploring some of these areas that might look pristine to the untrained eye?
Well, it became clear to me that aside from the obvious intrusions of humankind, like fences, logging projects, roads, and other developments, lodges, you name it, that the most ubiquitous and most deleterious impact over a larger area than anything else was livestock grazing and livestock impacts. And it's a relatively short period in the history of human settlement in North America that this has happened, but now it's extraordinarily oppressive on the environment and mostly overlooked by not only ordinary citizens who may not fully understand what's going on, but also by conservationists who have chosen to look the other way because of perhaps focus group information about the value of ranching.
So when did ranching really start to come into the public eye? I think it obviously has a very long way to go. And, you know, that's part of the impetus for this interview is to expose people to this issue. But is there maybe a turning point in history, in politics, when the impacts of grazing started to get looked at more closely?
Well, I would say that there were many people in government even that knew how bad things were a long, long time ago. My friend George Werthner just sent out a link to a U.S. Department of Agriculture report from 1936 that was so condemning and so completely truthful about the negative impacts of livestock on all kinds of values in the American West that it's shocking to read even today, even though many of those conditions continue today. But obviously people were understanding the problems a long time ago in relative terms. And really a short time after the release of livestock onto public lands in the West, which really only happened after the 1860s and peaked about 1890, and then saw new peaks in the 1920s and the 1950s. But it's economically, it's a declining activity and never was probably that valuable except during the World Wars when, for example, wool and mutton were in huge demand for the military and beef cattle became one of the foremost production requirements for the military. But the reality is that so little beef is produced in the American West that even if you eat beef, which I don't, you would not even notice a diminution if it disappeared tomorrow.
Something like 2% of all
beef? Yeah, it's about maybe a little more than 2% of the total beef production in the United States.
You know, looking back to the 30s, and, you know, we've got all this great science today. Often science is ignored in favor of industry and economics. What sort of subsidies are the American people or our government providing to support ranching on public lands?
Well, of course, there's a huge list of those subsidies. Some are more hidden than others. The most direct is, of course, the grazing fee on public lands is so low as to be absurd. In fact, at $1.35 a month for a 1,200-pound cow and a 500-pound calf, that's extraordinarily cheap. A single sheep costs 27 cents a month to keep on public lands at this time, and that's about 85% less than the government was charging 45 years ago when adjusted for inflation. And so that's a critically important thing for people to understand, that ranchers aren't paying even their fair share, however you would define that. And they also don't have to pay for all the other things that happen out there, like fencing, road construction, cattle guards, water troughs, the
wildlife services, killing
wildlife, that's right, for the benefit of ranchers. Just the random killing of coyotes has been a government policy for since 1914. And of course, wolves are in the crosshairs now in Idaho and other adjacent states because they kill the occasional calf. It's a misperception of the West to think that ranchers are a beneficial aspect of the West. If the grazing fee alone were raised to a market rate of, say, $20 from $1.35, I think this ranching would end in a week or two.
So I feel like there's a growing awareness today of public lands, and you know, when the Bears Ears National Monument reduction happened a couple years ago, I feel like this was a real watershed moment for public awareness. You know, perhaps grazing is is another area that we could be looking at and really examining our cost benefit of this practice and what we envision our public lands to be into the future. And we're looking at, of course, multiple use, and maybe we could talk about what that means, multiple use mandates. But we might be changing our attitudes today, and grazing could very well become something that moves into the crosshairs of what society would like to see change in our management.
Well, I'm proud to say that one of the reasons for the title of George Werthner's book,
Welfare Ranching,
is because he asked me what he should call the book, The Subsidized Destruction of the American West. Mm-hmm. I think one of the recent events that has caused people to think twice about ranching is the Clive and Bundy incident, which is an ongoing event, as you know, since he still has illegal cows out on public lands in southern Nevada and also in southwest Utah. And the fact that a rancher could call in a coterie of gun-wielding zealots to protect his illegal activity on public lands, I think maybe was a mistake on their part in the long run, because the Bundys represent an outlaw system of perspective on public lands. They don't even believe that the government can own land. And so it's important to focus attention on people like the Bundys, who represent an extraordinary misperception of the American West. And I think in time they will help bring about the need of change because their ideas are so outrageous.
What is multiple use and how does it apply to our public lands outside of wilderness areas?
Well, multiple use was a concocted scheme by the government and advocates for traditional extractive resource users groups and resulted in the passage of legislation in 1960, the Multiple Use Sustained Yield Act, which specifically directs that the BLM and Forest Service manage public lands for various extractive uses and also for recreation to a lesser extent. But make no mistake about it, the idea of multiple use is not one to share equally the lands which we all own. The idea was to maintain the status quo of domination of those lands by the exploiters. So multiple use is an archaic idea that needs to be eliminated, in my judgment, the sooner the better.
Kind of like the argument of balanced use for recreation, right? When we have motor folks, I'll call them, want to have access to all of the hiking trails as well, because that's what's fair, I suppose. But of course we know that these are incompatible uses of trails and also have negative impacts to wildlife that we are not considering. We talked a little bit about noise pollution, and of course I will always talk about noise on this program. Let's get back to your history, and I want to talk about the Idaho Watersedge Project. And what was the defining moment for you when you decided that you wanted to do something about what you were seeing?
That occurred in the summer of 1993. I had been involved in conservation efforts before that throughout the 1980s. I was even on a task force here in the Sawtooth National Recreation Area to decide what to do about ranching on salmon streams that was damaging the habitat for salmon. But in 1993, I was with two friends on an allotment called the Herd Creek Allotment in the eastern White Cloud Mountains, about 40 miles from here by as the crow flies. And we were standing on a small creek called Lake Creek, which had been cow blasted to smithereens. It was just dust and and cow shit and flies, and the stream was running muddy with cow shit and was deeply polluted, and yet I knew it was a rearing stream for anadromous fish and yet was being treated as a sewer by the rancher. And so with my two friends who were there with me at the time, I said, you know, this is really hard to explain to people because they don't even come to this place to see this. But I think that right along here on Lake Creek is a state-owned section of land. That's 640 acres. And I'm going to, when I get back home, I'm going to call up the State Department of Lands and find out how they lease these lands to ranchers. And that's what I did. And I found out that that particular state section in the Herd Creek allotment, which is split between the Forest Service and the BLM, was coming up for renewal that fall, the grazing lease. And I called the Department of Lands and asked them if there was any restriction on who could apply for an expiring grazing lease, which are 10-year leases. And the employee said, not that he knew of. And he said, in fact, there was a Supreme Court case from 1921 that resolved that whole issue, an Idaho Supreme Court case. And so I said, well, what's the deadline for applying for this lease? And he said, it's in 1 week. And I said, send me an application, which he did. I filed the application. I thought it'd be better to come from an organization instead of an individual, so I created the name, Idaho Watersheds Project, at that time, and applied for that lease, and then events exploded after that in a way that was completely unexpected to me, and because it was, I don't know, it was like as if the Muslims marched into St. Peter's Cathedral and threw the Pope down the stairs. At least that was the response. Seemed to be filled with fear and hatred that somebody who wanted a state lease not for the grazing but not to graze it caused an overreaction of extraordinary proportions, led by the Secretary of State of Idaho at that time, Pete Santarusa, who was a sheep rancher in his off hours.
So what was the climate like during all that? Like, what did you experience during that time?
Well, I experienced a lot of verbal abuse and a lot of threats. I received numerous death threats over several years, and some of them were quite humorous, actually. It just goes to show that people are afraid, generally speaking, to confront you individually, but would prefer to do it in a way that doesn't identify them. So one time I received a call on my office answering machine in the middle of the night, and a voice comes on and seemed to be somewhat inebriated and said, somebody ought to kill that John Marvel. And then there was silence for a moment. And then whoever it was on the phone fired a gun off twice right next to the phone. Bang, bang. And then started laughing and then hung up the phone. So that's the kind of thing that I experienced in relation to what we were doing as a small group, just trying to acquire leases to hold them for conservation, protection of natural resources, and pay the same rate as ranchers. And you would think that we had decided to burn the Bible.
Did anyone try to stop purchase of leases for conservation purposes?
Yeah, of course, the state of Idaho, even the state legislature, passed legislation to prevent this from happening. And the whole idea was that this was had to be stopped no matter what, at what cost. And so our small organization had to go to court to protect its interests, and we prevailed. I think the most important moment came in 1999 when Idaho Watersheds Project won three cases regarding the administration of state school trust lands in Idaho on the same day at the Idaho Supreme Court, all by unanimous decisions. And effectively that stopped the whole idea that the legislature could override the Idaho Constitution, which provides for these lands to be managed for the greatest long-term financial return, and also to be carefully conserved. That's also in the Constitution. Our Idaho Constitution is really not a very good document, in my judgment, but this was a small area of it that we could use to our benefit to protect public lands from the abuses, and also to impact the larger area surrounding these state leases on sections within large grazing allotments administered by the Forest Service and the BLM. And those larger areas had to take into account that their management was under scrutiny, too. And I would like to say that the Herd Creek allotment, in which this one section, which, by the way, Western Watersheds Project still holds the grazing lease on it today, more than 27 years later, that the Herd Creek allotment has been permanently retired from livestock grazing, 65,000 acres in the Jerry Peak Wilderness. And so I'd say applying for that lease back in September 1993 did change things in a dramatic way, although it's taken much longer than I thought it would.
What did Idaho Watersheds Project do between 93 and 1999? Like, what was your focus at that time?
Well, our focus was primarily on trying to influence public perception of public lands ranching and the management of all public lands for ranching by drawing attention to the degraded quality of state school trust lands within these larger allotments by applying for expiring grazing leases. 10% of all Idaho grazing leases expire every year. So over those 6 years, we had applied for, I think, over 100,000 acres of state grazing leases that were expiring and competed at auction for many of them. And we won many of those auctions. And the land board turned down some of our bids, and we had to litigate them. But we did have some fun during the effort. For example, during one land board meeting in Boise, I borrowed a briefcase from a friend of mine, a contractor. I said, "Steve, do you have a black leather briefcase?" And he said, "I do." And I said, "I need to borrow it." And he said, "What are you going to do with it?" And I said, "I'm going to stuff it with money and take it to the land board meeting." And this was before 9/11, so really there was no checking of baggage or luggage or backpacks or any kind of when you entered into a public building. And so I brought the briefcase into the land board meeting, and when then Governor Phil Batt of Idaho asked me up to the table to speak in front of the land board, there were about 50 people in the room. And I had put the briefcase up on the table next to me. And the governor said, "What's in that briefcase, John?" And I said, "I'm going to show you, Governor, because what's in this briefcase is all the money that you just failed to get for the school children of Idaho by turning down our winning bid for this particular state grazing lease, and I snapped open the briefcase and dumped $5,000 in $5 bills on the middle of the table in front of everybody. And there was this, everybody drew in their breath, and the governor said, "Take that away." And I thought, that is what you want, isn't it? Take it away. Well, that was a good moment.
So when did Idaho Watersheds Project transform into Western Watersheds Project?
I think it was in 2000. It became apparent that we were already doing work. We had segued into commenting on Forest Service and BLM grazing actions outside of the state of Idaho, including in Nevada, Eastern Oregon, Utah, Wyoming, Montana, and Eastern Washington. And, for example, even in the mid-90s, we had applied for expiring grazing leases in Utah and Wyoming. And we held leases in Utah for a while, for the term of the lease. And we competed for leases in Wyoming also. And so...
That's really loud. I might want to give that a minute. What do you think? Think he's headed into the wilderness somewhere?
He's probably going to Indian Creek on the Middle Fork. It's an airstrip there. As you know, a bunch of airstrips were grandfathered into the Frank Church Wilderness when it was created in 1980. And I think there were 11 or 12 airstrips that were grandfathered in. And so the rafting businesses take advantage of that by flying passengers in down the river 25 miles from the early season put in because the water's too low at the top to safely run people down in rafts. So they fly them in.
So you guys were working outside of Idaho by the time 2000 came around?
Yes, already. And had
you figured that maybe you need to expand your...
We needed a bigger geographic reference because... Obviously, the problem was much bigger than just the state of Idaho. And so also part of state law permitted us to just change the name of the organization administratively, provided it was simply a change in geographic, a use of a geographic term in the name. So changing Idaho to Western became almost... obvious as the thing to do as we expanded into all these other states.
What was your membership like at that time, and what sort of feedback were you receiving from people out there, the public?
I think the general public is remained still ignorant of the whole issue of public lands ranching, and so that was a strange experience for those of us who understood and went out on a daily or weekly basis to experience the degradation. You have to refresh my memory with your question again.
That's okay. Yeah, we had a garbage truck come through.
Yeah.
What were you hearing from the public, and also what was the involvement of your supporters that time?
We were a small organization at that time. We had fewer than 1,000 members, as I recall. Most of those members were at a very modest annual contribution, $10, $15, $20. I think it was 1999 was the first year that the organization ever received contributions of an individual contribution of $1,000 from somebody. But then we began to get more of those, and we were not particularly well received by the typical green foundations, the big green foundations, even in the Northwest, who regarded our efforts as too radical or upsetting for them.
Why do you think some of these larger groups like the Wilderness Society and the Idaho Conservation League have not addressed the grazing issue?
I think it's primarily because they're told by their funders not to. And also, I think they also carry out focus group analysis where you bring people into a room and ask some questions, and they may not be particularly well informed about a subject. And focus groups, when it comes to conservation and environmental issues, typically show in regard to public lands uses that people in general are opposed to clear-cut logging, they're opposed to mining of any kind, and they're highly favorably disposed toward ranching. And therefore, when quasi-conservation groups get information like this, they tend to say, well, we better stay away from that because 80% of the people think ranchers are actually environmentalists, and we need to support them and make sure they're happy. And so we never did that because we knew what was happening on the ground. And these groups that prefer to look the other way, many of the people who work for them understand the problem but don't want to ruffle feathers or cause waves. I remember talking to Bill Meadows, the then head of the Wilderness Society. I was asked to speak at a Great Old Broads for Wilderness meeting in Escalante, Utah.
Great group, by the way.
And I support the Great Old Broads myself. I am a Great Old Broad. And I asked Bill Meadows, just right to his face, I said, Bill, why is it the Wilderness Society ignores livestock grazing as an impact on just wilderness values, and not to speak of all public lands? And he said, oh, John, we just don't have the bandwidth for that, and we need to focus on the North Slope of Alaska and places that are at high risk from oil and gas exploration. And he said, we just can't do that. And I said, but your wilderness areas that have been designated over the years are being trashed by livestock. And he said, well, I just don't think we have the staff to deal with that.
What does Western Watersheds do today, and how has the organizational capacity grown since 2000?
Well, it's grown significantly, as you know. Many more members supporting the organization. There's a good level of support out there. The organization has, I think, 14 or 15 employees now in multiple states in the West, and is successfully in these difficult political times fighting against very, very bad BLM and Forest Service projects in numerous places, and even other activities. For example, the California director, Laura Cunningham, is active in these open space district management decisions in California, where these open space districts that often own tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of acres of land, manage them to benefit ranching and ignore other ecological impacts of that. And so it's a broadly based effort. Another in California I'd mention is the Point Reyes National Seashore effort, where ranching that was bought out for $67 million in the early 1960s is acting as if it's a grandfathered use when it never was. And They have dairy cows and beef cows taking up at least a third of the national seashore.
And can you talk about the Tule elk a little bit?
Yes, and of course the Tule elk, who were reduced to, I think, five individual elk at one time in the late 1800s, early 1900s, were reintroduced into Point Reyes, which of course was some of their native habitat originally, and now are treated. Part of the proposal from the National Park Service was to shoot tule elk that interfered with ranching in a national seashore. Well, you can't get a more disturbed idea about the mission of the National Park Service than that. That about sums it up right there, mm-hmm. how they've gone off the rails. It's like a true wreck out there. So
I saw a recent poll. It's something like 90% of the public supports removing ranching out there now, or I'm probably botching the numbers, but good example of the ranching conflicts with wildlife that people get to see because Point Reyes is a highly visited and well-known area. So when you extrapolate that out across the landscape, you can just kind of imagine what's happening in these places that people don't get to see all the time, that Western Watersheds is out visiting and commenting and reporting back to the agencies. So it's really important work, and I'm really impressed with the way the organization has grown and the capacity that you've built over the years.
Well, thanks. And what has always impressed me is the quality of staff for the organization. These are highly qualified, educated people who understand ecological processes and the conservation of life on Earth at the same time, and are dedicated and don't get paid very much money, and yet continue to do these things because they really matter to them. And that's a testament to the organization, I think, too, as well as to those individuals.
When you look back on your time with Western Watersheds and your history as an activist, addressing grazing issues, what do you think about when you reflect on Western Watersheds? Let's just be specific there.
Well, I'm very proud. I still wear the WWP hat here on a daily basis, and I think it's a genuine accomplishment that I feel very good about. I actually stupidly thought that change would come more quickly when I started doing this.
And I have to believe that, don't you?
You do. And I'm an inveterate optimist, actually, which I think helps as well. Not that it's reality-based or anything. I think it's a state of mind more than anything else. But also, I just mentioned that when I started Idaho Watersheds Project, I actually did an I Ching reading and asked I Ching what would be the outcome of this effort to end public lands ranching. And I got a hexagram back that said, enormous obstacles. And it turned out to be correct. There were and are continuing enormous obstacles, but I do think we have come a long way. And really, it's possible that a more ecologically interested Congress of the United States could very simply change a few statutes in a not a terribly great way, and it could radically alter and benefit public lands.
What do you think about a new Civilian Conservation Corps-type program that would go out and remove fencing and restore springs and riparian areas and really connecting our youth with our public treasure?
I'd be fully in support of that. Get young people out to see these lands and understand what's wrong and what can be made right. What could be wrong with that? It's a terrific idea.
Let's talk a little bit about legislative buyouts and how those came about and how they're used today.
Well, it's something I'm still involved in, as you know, seeking to pay ranchers a one-time payment to give up permanently their federal grazing permits. And the Sagebrush Habitat Conservation Fund, of which I'm one of the three board members, has retired about 1 million acres of public lands from ranching at this time. Recently, we succeeded in retiring 88,000 acres near Ketchum, Idaho, from sheep grazing. in perpetuity. But the real problem in doing this is that we don't have the statutory authorization for permanent retirement. And the large land management agencies, whether it's the Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management, the National Park Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, all manage ranching out there, it turns out that they, instead of understanding the benefits, just to them, bureaucratically speaking, of less oversight by removing ranching, are deeply invested in sustaining ranching as a bureaucracy. And that's hard to overcome because those agencies act as surrogates for ranching interests in a way that is deleterious to their own mission. And so we face that problem still. We need the statutory authority. And, of course, it's existed in numerous places. The California Desert Protection Act, the Oregon Caves National Monument, the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument, the Boulder White Clouds wilderness areas, the Owyhee Wilderness. These are just a few of the places where statutory retirement, permanent retirement of grazing, is authorized by Congress, and the agencies can't get in the way of it.
So that's why they're called legislative buyouts.
That's
right. You don't have these programs that are just across the board, across all agency land, right?
And we need that, and we're hopeful that if there's a change in administration in January, that there'll be more openness to that, because we're currently fighting an atavistic and, dare I say, Neanderthal perspective on domination of public lands and exploitation above all other values. If we can get past that, I think this is a simple change that enables voluntary relinquishment. It's not even coercive, even though I, for one, might well support coercive means.
Do you have a vision for the future of our public lands where grazing currently exists?
Yeah, of course I do. I'm maintained by this idea that in Western North America in particular, we have an extraordinary opportunity to reestablish the connectivity and ecological health of hundreds of millions of acres of land by removing the main stressor of those values, which is a non-impactful event, economically speaking or politically speaking. If we can overcome the politics of the situation, it's an opportunity that we can grasp fairly easily here and will enable a lot of beneficial changes to occur out there. This isn't to say it's the sole thing that needs to happen. We have industrial recreation, we have mining, we have logging, we have all those things still ongoing out there. But livestock grazing is the most ubiquitous use. It's the most negative use of lands on the entire earth. And if we can do it here on 200 to 300 to 400 million acres in Western North America, that's an example for the rest of the world to see how unnecessary that use is.
Can you quickly run through all the impacts that cows have on ecosystems?
Oh, well, it's a hugely destructive. It's kind of a low-pressure denigration of ecological processes that happens over time. The most obvious impacts have to do with riparian areas and streams in particular, which are deeply damaged by both cattle and sheep, but specifically cattle because they're the larger animal. And cattle come from a wet environment where they co-evolved with different landscapes in Eastern Europe. And cattle congregate at wet areas. And the streams represent maybe 1 to 2% of the landscape in the American West. Yet most important for biodiversity, fisheries, and life in general is all dependent on the tiny percentage of the landscape. if you remove that stress, those areas recover very quickly, riparian areas. The uplands, which have been depressed by livestock for a century and a half, take much longer to recover. But in fact, we know from studies of over 70 years on the Idaho National Laboratory, eastern Idaho, that native bunch grasses will outcompete cheatgrass over a 50-year time span. That's how long it takes. So we need to keep our time perspective in front of us to understand that those negative impacts on everything, ecological processes, but also other wildlife, for example, bighorn sheep are killed by disease brought from domestic sheep that they have no immunity for. And that's why we don't have bighorn sheep across the landscape. It's because of the presence of domestic sheep. We can change all that, and I think we will. We've already changed quite a bit.
I like thinking about wilderness-dependent animals and predators like grizzly bear and wolves. And,
yeah, no kidding.
You know, how does ranching impact the long-term survival and viability of genetic exchange and just general populations of our beloved predators and carnivores?
Well, ranching as established in the American West and or Canadian West or Mexican West for that matter is the culture of death. That's the simplest way to describe it. In other words, what that means is that any other life form that moves out there, you kill it because it could interfere with your ability. Now, in the case of a wolf or a grizzly bear, sure, it can eat you too. And so you kill it in order to get rid of it so it doesn't eat your livestock. And that's what we really have to overcome, is this idea of dominion over the earth that causes the killing of predators and everything else out there that moves, whether it's a rock chuck or a prairie dog or it doesn't matter. Even a deer can be blamed for eating grass that cows should have gotten. In regard to connectivity, if you have landscapes that are denuded of predators or carnivores of all sizes, you do lose that genetic interconnectivity that these animals would have had otherwise. Now, that's happening at all kinds of levels out there, whether it's roadways that prevent small animals from interconnecting, or any kind of human activity out there, like motorized recreation is another big impact on wildlife. And even non-motorized recreation has negative impacts. So, but by removing this huge stressor of the landscape, livestock across the West will be accomplishing a major, major benefit for really the survival of the human race, not to speak of all the other species that we've suppressed over these many decades.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd like to do an episode on trophic cascades at some point, but when we protect the areas for our predators, we're protecting everything, including
right.
including ourselves. So.
Yeah, including ourselves and the plant communities, too.
Yeah. Well, John, thanks for chatting with me. This has been great.
Well, you're very welcome, Adam, and welcome aboard, too.
I'm very grateful that Western Watersheds exists. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Wilderness Podcast. You can find us online at wildernesspodcast.com. Don't forget to subscribe through your podcasting app. If you'd like to support this podcast, please visit wildernesspodcast.com/support. Thanks for listening.